All right, please join me in welcoming our main speaker tonight, the wonderful, our own homegirl right here, homegrown, Janet Flores.
Hi everybody, my name is Janet Flores and I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here, it's good to be sober. And Anthony, he said that sometimes you just get local people. I thought he said local people. That used to be my placazo, my loca, you know, because I was crazy. I'm not crazy anymore. I'm not crazy anyway. I want to start before I say anything. I feel like I need to recite my prayer. I don't know it by heart, so I'm going to read it. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love, that where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness, that where there is discord, I may bring harmony, that where there is error, I may bring truth, that where there is doubt, I may bring faith, that where there is despair, I may bring hope, that where there are shadows, I may bring light. That where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Amen. Thank you. Thank you for asking me to share tonight. I'm very humbled that I would be asked to share. And I found in the doctor's opinion, in the Dr. Bob's nightmare, when asked why he spent so much time working with others, he said, there's four reasons. It's a sense of duty. It's a pleasure. Because in so doing, I am paying my debt to the, well, he put man, but it was men and women, who took time to pass it on to me. And the fourth, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against the possible slip. So that's why I'm here tonight, because it is a responsibility for every A member when asked to share my experience, faith, and hope. I hope someone here get something out of what I have to say. I worked real hard today to stay really busy so I wouldn't try to plan out what I was going to say. Because, I come from the world of academics and, you know, my mind wants to tell me, make an outline and do that. So I went and helped clean up the mesa and then I went home and did yard work and I screwed up my hip and here I am. I always start my pitch by talking about where my story would be if it was in the big book. And my story would be in section 2 of the story, they stopped in time. I don't have a horrific drug log, but I like to read this. I'm sorry for all the reading, but like I said, I'm an academic. It says, they stopped in time. Among today's incoming AA members, many have never reached the advanced stages of alcoholism, though given time, all might have. Most of these fortunate ones, which I consider myself a fortunate one, have had little or no acquaintance with delirium, with hospitals, asylums, and jails. Well, a little bit experience with jail. Some were drinking heavily, and there have been occasional serious episodes. But with many drinking, had been little more than sometimes uncontrollable nuisance. Seldom had any of these lost either health, business, family, or friends. I later found out I didn't lose any of that because I never got it. Why do men and women like these join AA? They realize that repeated lack of drinking control, when they really wanted control, was the fatal symptom that spelled problem drinking. This, plus mounting emotional disturbances, convinced them that compulsive alcoholism had them. That complete ruin would be only a question of time. That's what happened to me. I knew if I kept on doing what I was going to do, that it was just going to be a matter of time before I'd end up like all of you. He said, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. Seeing the dangers that came to AA, they realized that in the end, alcoholism could be as mortal as cancer. Certainly, no sane man or woman would wait for a malignant growth to become fatal before seeking help. Therefore, these 17 AAs and hundreds of thousands like them have been saved years of infinite suffering. They sum it up something like this, quote, we didn't wait to hit bottom because, thank God, we could see the bottom. Actually, the bottom came up and hit us. That sold us on Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's exactly what happened to me. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I thought I was an alcoholic or because I thought I needed help. Thank you very much for having a good time partying. And I thought I was having a good time. I started drinking when I was maybe 15 or 16. Not heavily. I was experimenting. I call him the pusher man, but one of my friends from my neighborhood. I grew up in a little town called Shafter near Bakersfield. And actually, I didn't grow up in Shafter. I grew up 3 miles out of town where a lot of the people who got there in the 20s during the Dust Bowl, my grandparents worked on the railroad, and a lot of the family worked on the railroad then. And so they decided to settle in that town, and they were sold land 3 miles out of town because the people in town, they don't want all those Mexicans having all those parties and shooting guns up in the air and doing everything that they were doing. So they sold them the property up there, and my great grandfather was one of those people. So that's where I grew up. My father was very Catholic and very committed to cleaning the church and doing all that, so we used to accompany him, but he used to drink. Can't pronounce him an alcoholic, but he had some of the symptoms. And when I was 10, I discovered him in a theater with another woman. So I quickly ran to tell my mother. The next thing I know, I see his back walking out the door with a suitcase. You know, and then, of course, I blame myself for being a snitch. But I don't know. What do you know when you're 10, you know? My mom didn't drink, my grandfather, my uncle, they all lived with us, and nobody drank. But I was unhappy. I was my dad's little girl, and I think when he left, I was really sad about that. And I just kind of didn't realize that until I did my step work. But there was this, one of the characters in that little water that I grew up in, decided that he would try to had me and his girlfriend, that was my best friend, try these little red pills. And so we tried the little red pills, and it was Tylenol. And it got us like drunk. And I liked that feeling. Yeah, I never drank because I liked the flavor. I always drank for the effect. And my mom ended up discovering that I was playing around with those pills. She made a comment about, oh my God, I can't believe you're on drugs. At least if you were drinking, oh, okay, yeah, I'm going to do that, you know. So I started drinking, and so I promised her I would never do drugs again, and I didn't, but I did drink. I didn't really realize alcohol was a drug. So that's how my drinking started, and I drank, you know, periodically in high school. I was a pretty good student, but I did used to, you know, ditch. And I was a responsible ditcher, though, because I was a ditch, and then I would go back to school after school and get all my assignments from my teachers, and then do all my homework and turn it in, because that was one of the things my mom wanted me to graduate from high school. And it came easy, so I did it. But that was the first, you know, cheating and lying kind of thing that was going on with me. I was a cheater and I was a liar, but I didn't realize it. At the time, I thought I was very smart. I'm so smart. Look at me. I'm getting all my work done. my girlfriend was in the lucky, she ended up dropping out and getting pregnant, but I had a mission. I wanted to go to college, and I wanted to do that, so I tried to make sure I finished. Anyway, my drinking really took off in college. You know, I didn't realize alcoholic, but you know, the way I picked my school was, it was the number one party school in California, San Diego State. This was back in 1974. Number one party school in the state of California, according to what they told me. These musicians came to my junior college to perform. They convinced me to go to San Diego State. I had a boyfriend at the time, and he wanted me to go to San Jose State. But they convinced me that that was the number one party school, and it was near Tijuana, that I could go to bars in Tijuana at 18, you know, and Rosarito, and Ensenada, and I was like, San Jose? Tijuana, Ensenada, San Jose. So I told him that I applied, but I didn't. And then when I got into San Diego State, oh my God, I'm San Diego State. He says, what, how come you didn't say, I don't know why. Then the next time I see him, he goes, my cousin works in the office and you didn't even apply. You're a liar. I'm a liar. Hey, listen, I got my application. And then he says, you want to go to San Diego State because of all those Stainers over there. And I go, they're Stainers? I didn't know they were Stainers. I didn't know. I've never been to San Diego. And, you know, I don't know, but this is alcoholic behavior, but I didn't know where I was going to live, but those guys, those musicians, they told us, don't worry about where you're going to live. Just come knock on our door. You can stay with us. So that's what I did. I packed up my car and knocked on their door. And they said, oh, hi. You said we could come in here. You know, me and my girlfriend, my other girlfriend, and you know, they introduced me to Tijuana, and I never had drank tequila before. I just used to drink beer. And I drank beer, you know. And this was Janice Flores, you know. I was valedictorian. I made my high school speech for graduation. And here I am, you know, going back to tequila and eating carnitas and just having a ball, you know, which made school a little more interesting because, you know, there was times I had to lie to my teachers and tell them that things like, my father died. I can't take that exam. My father died. You know, and they were so sorry for me and gave me a break. And so I got my work done, like I was able to pass, you know. But, you know, there were times I did ridiculous things. Like, I took science 3 times. That's in the past science. I don't know why. Couldn't understand it. They didn't have all the computers they have now, you know? I'm like, what's a photon and a proton? And I don't understand. I can't see it. I cannot see it. So I just like, I'm not going to take this class one more time. And, we were in a big hall, and this was before computers, you know, just then. So the teacher decides to go off and go to the bathroom or something. And I get down those stairs, and I go to his grade book. And the little gas on him, I turned him into A. I passed the class. I still don't know what a proton is. And I haven't had to use that information either. I was a psychology major. And I just, you know, when I would do things like that, you know, I would justify it. Because I've been justifier, and I came up, you know. I got the class, and not able to deal with that anyway. I'm not going to be, I'm not going to, I don't even know about science. I don't even know about math. I used to write the answers on my shoe. I'm a cheater. But I didn't cheat on my major. I took out a study, I left it out, and like, I didn't cheat on that. I just cheated on the things I didn't think I was going to need. But now that I don't even know how to do a budget, I think I should learn math. So, I drank in college, but my drinking really took off after I graduated. I was in grad school. I had never been to a single bar. I'd never been to a disco. I just used to drink at parties, you know, parties where we had kegs and like one time the not the sorority, what was the other one, the fraternity. across the street from our party started throwing bottles at us, and then somebody from our party started shooting, and then the cops came, and I'm drunk, and they're like pointing a rifle at me and telling me, get on the floor, and I'm like, no, there's grass down there. I'm not going to get on the floor. And all my friends are on the floor because they threatened them. And then the guy pointed the gun at me, and I'm like, no, I'm not going to get down there. You pig. You know, I had no respect for authority, and I was calling them names, and my friends are going, he's going to shoot you. Get on the floor. You're Mexican. They're going to shoot you. So finally I get on the floor and see what they said. That's the kind of things that I used to do. I think I had a problem with alcohol. I had a problem with the cops. You know, they were discriminating against us. You know, and I moved back to Bakersfield because I was in a relationship, and one day I decided to surprise them. And when I got there, there was female clothes all over the place. And now this guy, you know, he was my boyfriend. I was my boyfriend the whole time I was in college there, and I helped him. He was a drug addict. I tried to help him. You know, I tried to get him to go to a program, and he got caught. He got caught at the border because he had a little bit of heroin on him at the international border. You're going to federal prison. And I did all kinds of stuff to help that guy. And this is in April. I would cross kilos under the seat of my car and sell them to pay for his lawyer. Just ridiculous. When he was in prison, I would sneak in drugs for him. Ridiculous. Now, that's what a faint, sober person does. No, but I didn't think about it like that. I just thought of loyal and dedicated and in love. And this is the guy that, you know, surprised me when I was in surprise him. So what do I do? What if you want to get drunk with the guy who gave me a ride? You know, okay, he's married, but, you know, well, things happen. And that's the kind of shit I used to do, you know. And I would tell him I was a little faithful, but I wasn't, you know. I wasn't faithful. A liar, cheater that I was. That's the kind of lifestyle that I took on, you know. And I had no conscious of God at that time. I really didn't. I had rejected my Catholic upbringing because I felt like I would be a hypocrite. Here I am lying, cheating, and doing all these things that I was told not to do. So how could I believe in God? Plus, you know, one of my aims then was to be, I wanted to be like a social justice leader. I wanted to be like Cesar Chavez, like Martin Luther King. I wanted to be, you know, one of those guys. I don't think they might have cheated like me, but and dressed like I did, but I wanted to be like that. And I studied all kinds of theories, social theories, like Marx and Mao. You know, so I started believing that there was no God, and I started believing that religion was the opiate of the masses. And so when I came to AA, I didn't really have a concept of God. I had one from way back when I was little, because I used to love church, and I used to go to church with my dad. But I had forgotten all about that, you know. I forgot about that, and I forgot about the morals that my mom taught me, you know. I was waking up with guys that I didn't know, like, what the hell, you know. But anyway, getting back to, I discovered disco, and I got anxiety on the hair. The disco ball, the skirt, the big hair. Oh, now I had money. You know, I came back, I had a job, I had a degree, I could work, and yeah, that's what I did all the time. I was at the disco all the time. You know, then I met this guy, he was a bartender. Got me drunk. I woke up with him. Woke up, and he wasn't there. And I'm like, where the hell am I? And here's my car. And I walk out, and there's this girl walking from the back of the house. I'm like, oh, shit. And she says, are you looking for it? And I go, I'm looking for it. I couldn't remember the name. She goes, Joe? And I go, yeah, Joe. He goes, oh, he has to work. He's a fireman. I'm like, oh, okay. So that's the kind of stuff they used to do. Ridiculous, right? But I didn't have a problem with alcohol. I had a problem with, you know, guys getting me drunk, taking advantage of me. So anyway, I had a series of jobs. I was a teacher. I was the, you know, all kinds of stuff. I got paid for my teaching job, and I had to find a job. So I was also teaching at this community college, teaching Chicano studies and psychology. My final word was a party at my house with a taker. The students love me. And all of a sudden, I can't find a job. I go looking for jobs, I can't find a job, can't find a job. Finally, I see this ad for an alcoholism counselor, and I say, oh, okay, I think I can get this job. I'm bilingual, and I'm bilingual, I have a degree in counseling, and I think I can do this job. So I went into the interview, and I think I can do this job, because I had a lot of confidence. It was a lot of ego to do this job, but you just need to send me the training, because I don't know anything about alcoholism. And they go, okay, we'll send you training. Send you training. Sent to UC San Diego. Got my certificates and I came back. And now we want you to go to A meetings because we're a social model program and you need to know about AA. Here's a big book. Here's a 12x12. Read these books. So take the clients to these meetings. Okay. So I'm sitting there listening to you guys going, oh shit, I've done that. Oh, that happened to me. Oh, I go to women's meetings and then I really hear stuff that I did. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. So in the big book I found that there's different kinds of drinkers, and one was a heavy drinker. Heavy drinkers can stop when they have a sufficient reason for stopping. Oh, I'm a heavy drinker, that's me. I'm a heavy drinker, so I'm an alcoholic, but they can stop. You know, I can stop, I don't need to stop. I don't need to stop for it. I don't have a sufficient reason to stop, you know. As my alcoholism progressed, I got a lot of reasons to stop that I didn't stop. Like the board of directors that I picked, because I started this agency. I started an outpatient agency in a women's recovery home. And the board asked me if I could stop drinking in public because the clients were making comments about it to me. Now, that should have been a sufficient reason to stop. But I didn't think it was a sufficient reason to stop. It was a reason to drink alone at home, you know. That was the reason. That was my next move, was I'm just going to drink alone at home. So, you know, I was a director. I used to wear suits to work, and I'd wake up with my suit, with my, you know, dumped over on my couch because I was, my last drink that I used to like to drink was Black Russian, and I used to make one drink in my tie glass, huge glass like that. Looks just like the little Black Russian glass, but it's huge. It looks like they made it big, and that's what I drank, and I just started realizing that maybe I needed to stop drinking. I put on this, you know how you used to have no smoking days? I put on no drink day, a day where you don't drink, you know, a sober day. And I did a lot of research because I had just got interviewed on TV about this day, and I talked about how it has, my program was for Spanish speaking, for Hispanic clients. Talked about this, how horrible drinking has become in our community, and our families are being destroyed, and I said, you know what, I need to stop drinking, you know, I'm professing all this, and I'm not doing it, I'm going to stop drinking, now, this might be the reason, I'm stop drinking, so I started going to going to clubs and stuff, like, or parties with my friends, and they asked me to drink, and I'm like, no, I'm not drinking, I'm not drinking no more, I don't drink anymore, don't you know how bad it is for our people, and, you know, by the end of the night, I was drinking again, you know. And then I heard people in the meetings, I heard this one guy say, you know, I can stop drinking because I could stop drinking for a while. He says, my problem is I can't stay stopped. Because I can stop for weeks or days or months, but eventually I drink again. And I remember the story of the Jim, the one who puts the whiskey in his milk. You know, how he had gone to, his prior business, and his father-in-law worked there or something, and he was angry about that, and then, he was, you know, humiliated because he had to have a lower position, and then he goes and orders a sandwich, and all of a sudden he gets milk, and then he puts the whiskey in it, and he doesn't even realize why he did it, that it just happened, you know. But I realized that he was angry before that, you know, and I started realizing that when I get angry and things don't go my way, that used to be my go-to. Oh, I gotta get happy. I gotta go have fun. I gotta get party. And I never called drinking, I called it party. I never called club bars, I called them clubs. Because somehow, that just made it legitimate. It made me not an alcoholic. And, so, I remember that story. And, the day I took my last drink was the day that, I was seeing this guy in LA, and he asked me if I could go home because his mom was going to be coming to visit, and he wanted to spend time with her alone. And I'm not very understanding, but I pretended that I was. And he had given me some liquor to get to my sister, and I had it in the car, and I stopped to get some coffee. And all of a sudden, I said, "Can I have a cup of ice?" And I took that liquor and I poured it in the ice, and there I go. Drinking after I hadn't drank so much. And I saw those cop lights, you know. And I thought, oh my God, I'm gonna get stopped. My life's gonna be ruined, my agency, everything, you know, everything I worked for. And that's the only thing I had was my career. Because I had never got married, I hadn't had kids, hadn't bought a house, you know, I didn't have very many friends, so all my friends would be partiers, and when I stopped drinking, they all stopped being my friends. And I didn't, you know, have very much to lose except my career. And it was just, I could see it going down the drain. And I just remembered that people in these meetings said that they prayed. And I said, I don't really believe God, I don't really believe you, I don't believe in you that much, or whatever, but please, please help me, please. I'll go to AA tomorrow, and I'll stop. I'll get help. And the cop just passed me by. Mm-hmm. Wasn't even taking me. But I did. The next day I went to have a noodle with my mom, and when I was going to my car, she turned around and she told me, "Janet, please don't drink today." And that just cemented that I would have a big problem, because if my mom was noticing, then I was, you know, I was in trouble. So I went to the meeting and I said I was an alcoholic, and it was like the best thing that ever happened to me, you know. I commenced to do the steps. I realized that step one I had already done, you know, because I came to the realization that my behavior was deplorable. I was totally a hypocrite, which I never wanted to be, you know, drinking and running an alcoholism program, and, you know. And so I looked at the steps on the wall, and I started working the steps. Step one, yes. I'm powerless, yes. Step two, oh yeah, I do believe now in God because I asked him to help me, so I must believe. And I thought I was doing the steps, like, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. And then one day, after a few weeks or months, I can't remember a lot of life, but I told this old timer, "This sucks." I'm like, I thought this was going to be cool, being sober. I go, "Is this what we do every Friday night? Have a birthday meeting, big old cheese cake, everything blows the candles out, dip all over it, and we cut it up and eat it. That's ridiculous. So many germs." And I said, "Obviously you're not happy." I go, "No, I'm not happy. I'm miserable. You know, I'm irritable. I'm miserable. And I'm discontent. Like they talk about in those meetings." And he says, "Well, it's because you haven't worked the steps." "I worked the steps right there on the wall." He says, "Yeah, that's the way they came out off the wall." He says, "The instructions are in the big book. You know, instructions are there. You need to follow those instructions, you know." And so I commenced to do that. He took me home to my house, and we read each chapter, and he made me do all the writing, and he went and took a nap. He goes, "Where's your bedroom?" I go, "Hey, what do you mean with my bedroom?" He goes, "No, I'm going to go take a nap while you do this work." I'm like, "Okay." So he's doing it. you know, and, you know, I remember even hearing about that too, you know. First you come, then you come to, then you come to believe. And I learned that I needed to believe before I could have any faith, you know. And the faith that I finally acquired was by listening to all of you talk about how faith had worked in your life, you know. Joey Harvey talked about, you know, how you develop that. First you have to believe. They say it's like, you know, your car breaks down and you ask somebody where you should take it and they tell you, and you believe them because they've gone there and it's been successful for them. So you believe them, so you go on, you know, you have faith that they're talking, that they're doing it. They fix your car and they fix it good, and then you start developing faith, you know. So belief becomes faith, you know. And but in the big book, it's a faith without works is dead. So I can't stop there. I have to keep going, you know. So I did that. I came to believe because they told me all you need is a little mustard seed of faith. All you need is to be willing to believe. And I am willing because I want to get sober. And step 12 says I have to have a spiritual awakening. How am I going to have a spiritual awakening if I don't believe? I have to believe because I started, you know, looking for God. And I remember being at Barnes & Noble trying to find a book that would lead me to God. And it was the funniest thing happened. There was this book sticking out like that. Of all the books, it was sticking out. And I went over and it was compulsive that I was going to push it back in. And I grabbed it and I said, how to find God. So I was like, oh my God, I'm buying this, you know. And I told this lady in AA, Charlie, I said, she goes, what are you doing now? I'm looking for God. I'm looking for God. She goes, I'm trying to find God. She goes, have you ever tried to find something that you didn't think existed? You know, like, are you looking for things that don't exist? I said, well, no, that's ridiculous. She goes, well, then you already believe. You already believe that you're looking for it, you know. She told me to read the chapter on the agnostics again, and I started understanding more, you know, about how God is within me, and deep down inside, that's where I need to look, not out there, and that helped me a lot, because of that, I was able to do step three. I was able to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, and I learned that that's not really what you're doing. You're not turning your will and your life over to God. You're making the decision to do that. And in doing that decision meant that I was going to do the rest of the steps. You know, and I always tell my sponsees, you know, it's like when my ex husband asked me to marry him. He said, will you marry me? I had to make a decision. I said, stupidly, yes. I didn't consult with my sponsor. I didn't pray. I didn't do any of the things that I should have done. I said yes. But that didn't mean I was married. It just meant that I made a decision, you know. It meant that I was willing to do the rest of the process to make that happen. And that's what step three is for me, you know. It was me making that decision, that commitment to proceed. And it was in step four that I came to realize what a liar and a cheat I have been, you know. I had this whole list of defects, but they were all the same thing. They were just pretty words for deceitful, you know, manipulative. I had all these words, but all it all boiled down to liar, cheat, and thief. And I just, you know, there was a couple of things that I didn't want to tell my sponsor at the time. And although it said you shouldn't keep things to yourself, I did. There were things I didn't want to say. I wanted to take to the grave with me, you know. Was it until I had like 10 years of sobriety that I decided I'm going to be able to talk, but I'm going to go talk to a priest. So I'm going to talk to a priest at the mission. And I went, Father, it's been 22 years since my last confession. You know, I'm in this program, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I left out some stuff, and he goes, oh my goodness, and he throws back the curtain, and he goes, I'm a friend of Bill, too. Oh, no, I have to say. sat down with me and we talked, and I told him the biggest thing I was afraid of, and gave me absolution, and I told him about how I had amends to make, and I never got to make it because I had cussed out a priest when I was in college. I was drunk, and I cussed him out. And every time I go to San Diego, I'd want to go see him, but then I wouldn't do it. I procrastinated, and then when I finally got the courage to do it, they told me it passed away. So I told the priest that. Like, I never got to tell him, and he said, you know what, he forgave you the moment you said it. And it just took away all my guilt and made me feel better about that. But I have to 9:30, right? So, anyway, I'm really on tip 4. I got another sponsor, and I told her everything, and she told me I needed to forgive myself, that I would be really hard on myself. And that really helped me doing my step 5. And, you know, step 6 and 7, you know, I have to become completely willing to let go of those defects. And the way I understood the process was I needed to become willing to let them go because I wasn't willing. I liked some of those things because it got me through a lot of problems and cheating and lying and stuff like that. And I had to do the opposite. I was very arrogant and I was very self-willed and I was very aggressive, I guess you would call it. I didn't like to do what people told me, and I didn't like to be told no. So I had to learn how to be the opposite of all that. I had to learn how to stop being a liar and a cheat and a thief. And I remember they told me to act as if I was already not those things. I found a microwave at one of the big box stores, and the first thought was, oh my God, it came up. Well, I didn't even need a microwave, and nobody I knew needed a microwave, but it was old habit to think I came up on this, you know. Somebody forgot it. So I said, okay, I have to do the opposite. So I went in, I took the microwave. And I'll never forget this because the person that worked at it, oh my God, you're so honest. And I was like, yeah. My second thought, I'm honest. And I said, yeah, actually, if I'm honest, yes. Oh, well, of course, somebody's going to come back for it. And most people just would have taken it. You're so honest. I really, and she was so impressed with that it made me feel good, you know, made me kind of put my head up and look at her in the eyes. And I felt like I had some integrity. And that felt good. It felt good. And, you know, every time I practiced the opposite of a defect, I got a very positive reaction. Like, I used to lie. Even at 2 years, I was lying, you know, not big lies, but I was like, lie that I was late to work because the train passed by, stuff like that. I was at a meeting and Dave Christie was there, and I had just moved to the area, and he told me, hey, you're new to this area, do you need a job? And I go, no, I have a job. I called him sick. And he goes, are you sick? And I go, no, I'm not sick. And he goes, oh, you lie. I'm like, well, I'm a white guy, but it's a lie. And he goes, you want to stop lying? And I go, yeah, I really do. I do that a lot. And he goes, I'll tell you how. How? He gets right in their face and he goes, stop lying! The next day, I was late to work because I was late to work. And I walked in, my boss was sitting there, and he looks at the clock and he goes, and he looked at me and I go, I'm sorry, I overslept. Because I didn't lie, I told the truth. And he goes, oh, it happened. See, I realized that the reason I lied so much was because I had a lot of fear. I didn't like to take consequences. I wanted to play and not get caught. Or play and not suffer any consequences, you know. I learned that I needed to be on time, that I needed to not take my students out of my time or their time with me, and that I was staying up late because I was being selfish and self-centered, watching movies or doing whatever I wanted to do. And I had to change all that behavior so that I wouldn't have to lie, you know. And the thing is that I'm running out of time, and I didn't need to talk so much about my struggle with it. I really have learned so much in this program about how to change my behavior, you know. And it's all because of God and having found that spiritual connection. I learned not only to have faith, and to believe and to have faith, but to rely on God. God is my anchor today, you know. I've gone through a lot of things in sobriety, more than I have when I was drinking. I've lost my mom when I was 5 years sober. My son's father that I met in AA left me with a 4-day-old son. I just had a lot of things happen that I've had to cope with, and the only way I could cope with them was with following the steps and living this program, you know. They said that we're going to have a spiritual awakening, a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism, and I believe that's happened to me. My last couple years ago, my brother passed away, and I had to tend to him. And more recently, my son passed away. And I don't think I could have gotten through all that without my higher power, you know, without relying on that strength that I get from my higher power, that spiritual awakening that's given me the opportunity to deal with life on life's terms. And before I leave, I know I'm over time, but I always say my talk with my favorite line, with my favorite little story in the book, and I'm probably trying to find it, you see. That's not fair. Anyway, I'll just skip it today, but it's in the story on the Keys to the Kingdom, and it talks about how this program and the people in it have been a blessing to me, you know. When I was going through the darkest time, about 6 months ago, my son passed away, and people just surrounded me with love. You know, they came to my house, they cleaned my garage, they helped me with my house, they cooked food for me. They just were remarkable. Called me, texted me, and some of them still do. Still calling me, texting me, taking care of me. I really appreciate everything that AA has done for me. And I'm sorry to take the rest of my story, but thank you for listening.
Let's give Jen another round of applause. Good job.